masculinity is in China's modern military. So, David.
So that was my question. Is David here? Maybe not. Okay. Well, you know,
I think we'll rearrange
the order. I guess I could start. Yeah, has anybody talked to him today?
No, I think he just wrote a new book on Boxwood Bill.
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
We hear him speak.
So.
Maybe he's having trouble finding the place, huh?
Not that, no. Okay.
Well, if anybody meets him later on,
remind him that we're kind of. So this means that the people on this panel, we get to talk longer, right? Unless he shows up, and then we'll be really hard pressed.
This means we have a chance of getting back on schedule.
That's right. Well, anyway, my paper grows out of a long-term research interest I have on the relationship between military force and social and political power in modern China. But it's also somewhat a return to one of my earlier interests in one manifestation of that relationship, and that is modern Chinese warlordism. My earlier work on warlordism, though, focused much more on how military force became a foundation for political power in the Republican period. And this paper is, in turn, more interested at least on how more interested in how at least some warlords turn this power into personal wealth. And I say some warlords here, I want to emphasize that, some warlords. I'm not making a broad generalization about all warlords. I think there's a tendency at time when we're talking about warlords to take their kind of negative personal qualities as if these are defining characteristics. So, for example, to say that warlords, by definition, are violent, corrupt, immoral, reactionary, and so on. So we take these kind of qualities and make that as part of our definition of what is warlordism. But as a matter of fact, there's a lot of variation among different warlords or from one warlord to the next. And we do have warlords that are reactionary conservatives. We also have warlords who are kind of progressive politically. So you can't simply tar all warlords with the same kind of qualitative brush or kind of a normative brush. Having said that, though, these personal behaviors are not very useful in defining what warlordism is. They're still really relevant in terms of understanding the rise of specific warlords or how specific warlords behaved as warlords. And also in some ways how warlordism came to be perceived in the popular mind. So some of these negative behaviors become defining characteristics because that is how they are defined in kind of popular understanding. So this paper is actually focusing on one aspect of this kind of popular image of warlords, and that is warlord corruption. And I'm looking at one of my favorite warlords I actually looked at in my earlier book on warlordism as well, Wang Zhanyuan, who I think is somewhat of a kind of poster child for warlord corruption. The wealth he accumulated as military governor of Hubei from 1915 to 1921 actually made him one of the wealthiest men of his era. So he emerges as this extremely wealthy person, all based on what he did as a warlord in Hubei in this very short period of time. But my goal here in this paper was not simply to provide an example of warlord corruption and detail, you know, how corrupt they were. I mean, I think that's kind of just understood. Corruption is widespread for actually all officials in China, not just warlords. That's a kind of common characteristic. But what I'm going to try to do is place our understanding of this corruption in a little bit stronger theoretical framework. And so what I'm trying to do is show how Wang's career can be seen as an example of something I want to call one particular form of warlordism that I'm going to call predatory warlordism. And my choice of this term actually owes a debt to a theoretical discussion, mainly among political scientists and sociologists, surrounding a concept of predatory rule or predatory rulers. One problem with this debate, after I read all this material on predatory rulers and predatory rule, is that none of them have ever come, they haven't yet gelled into a consensus on what this means. So almost every person who discusses this concept, so the term is out there, but everybody that uses it in a slightly different way, usually specifically by looking at their example they're doing, and I'm doing the same thing in some ways. But what I'm trying to do is create some way of using this term as a particular form of warlordism or particular aspect of warlordism. And for that purpose, then I have to create my own definitions. So I define predatory rule as a form of governance whereby political position is deployed to maximize the ruler's personal power and private wealth to the detriment of the public good. So that sense of the predatory aspect of the term itself, that you're actually preying on society for some kind of personal gain, not just taxing people to support the government. It has to be something that reflects back on the ruler. And then based on this, then I define predatory warlordism as a situation under which the control of military force is the primary means by which political power is obtained and through which predatory rule is manifested. So again, I'm trying to link this back to the base of military force as the base of power, which then becomes predatory in how it reacts on society. And I think Wang Zhanyuan's career shows two features of this predatory warlordism. One thing is that the conditions of warlordism itself, such as the consolidation of military and civil administration in one regime, and also then the lessening of any kind of external controls or limitations on warlords from the outside, or warlord regimes from the outside, actually enhance their capacity for corruption. So the conditions of warlordism itself created the conditions that make corruption possible, more possible, always there, but more possible, and also particularly in terms of personal enrichment. So you have this possibility for personal enrichment. The second point I want to make, though, is that nonetheless, so you have this warlordism creates conditions for corruption and personal enrichment, but there is also a factor of personal choice in the degree in which individual warlords decide to use their power for personal enrichment as compared to other goals. So there is a decision being made. It's not that everybody is equally corrupt and their main goal is to become personally wealthy. You make a decision about how wealthy you want to be in terms of using your money in different directions. And I think we're going to see this very clearly in the case of Wang Zhanyuan. Wang Zhanyuan is actually a good example of also how military force became a channel for social mobility in the early 20th century. So he actually comes out of a very poor kind of family. He's got no real career path, no education when he starts out. He's basically illiterate when he starts out. He joins Li Hongzhang's Huai army in the late Qing dynasty. After the Sino-Japanese War, he's moved over to Yuan Shikai's new army, the Beiyang army. And it's in the Beiyang army then that he begins to rise through the ranks and also gets at least some education. There's a lot of debate about how illiterate he actually was. He was somewhat literate, but not really literate. So he had kind of semi-illiterate. But he rises through the ranks. Right after the 1911 revolution, he fought against the revolutionary forces in Wuhan. He was promoted to division commander. So this is pretty good military mobility in terms of his ability to go from this kind of poor village boy to a division commander in a very short period of time. By 1914, he was assigned to garrison Hubei province. So he had fought in Hubei province, he'd moved back to Henan, then back to Hubei, and then back to Wuhan area. But also his rise to power in Hubei is also kind of a good reflection of the process of warlordism at work. And that is the ability of military commanders to make use of the military force they control to obtain political power. And we see this very clearly in the case of Wang Zhanyuan. Yuan Shikai's original strategy in placing Wang Zhanyuan in Hubei was not to make him military governor. He was to be the military force at the military governor would use. He has a series of military governors in Hubei, so they are military governors, but they have no, drawn from the military officers, Yuan's military officers, but they do not have any direct control over their own military forces. They're not allowed to bring military forces with them. They're supposed to give orders to Wang Zhanyuan to go do whatever they're supposed to do. So the real effort to separate actual control of military force from military administration, that was the ideal anyway. So Yuan Shikai is actually trying to prevent the control of warlordism. What happens, of course, is when Yuan Shikai decides to make himself emperor, he needs all the allies he can get. And basically, Wang Zhanyuan bargains with him that if you want me to support you to be emperor, I need the military governor's position. And he gives it to him. So he's now gained control over military administration. After Yuan Shikai dies and Li Yuanhong becomes president, Li Yuanhong also needs to curry favor with all the people in the provinces. So he actually lets him take control over the civil administration, becomes civil governor as well. So at that point, by 1916, 1917, he gains control over both the military and civil administration of Hubei. And that's really then his control is fairly absolute. So at this point then, for as all warlords, the only reason why he's able to gain this power, though, is of course because he has military force. That's his bargaining chip, right? You have to make me military governor because I have military force. You have to make me civil governor because I have military force. You need my support. That also means that once he becomes military and civil governor, his main goal is to ensure the stability of his military force and to expand that military force. That his political capital is actually his military force. So from that, as soon as he gains control, he begins to expand his army. Now, he starts out with one division, the Beiyang 2nd Division. He ends up with two divisions and seven brigades, or actually like three brigades and four mixed brigades, which are a bit larger. So that's a fairly good expansion of military forces. He also, though, gains control of some other armies that kind of end up in Hubei during different conflicts that have nowhere else to go, and he allows them to stay in Hubei. So there's a very large expansion of military forces. The main problem for Wang Jianyuan at that point then is ensuring that he has sufficient finances to support this army. So the army is growing bigger every year. How do you actually support that? In theory, almost all of the forces under his control he gains national designations for. So they're national army units. What that means in theory is that the central government is responsible to pay all of his troops. But by 1917, 1918, 1919, basically the national treasury is empty. There's no way they can pay all the national armies. And what the central government does, of course, is tell the local warlords, basically, you have to find your own provincial revenues to support your armies. So, therefore, he became responsible not just for his own armies, but all the other national armies that end up somehow in Hubei. He had to find support, finances for that from within provincial resources. So they begin to pursue a number of different measures to help pay for his armies. He withholds all central taxes when he can to keep them. Any central taxes should have gone to Beijing. This is part of Beijing's problem. He keeps those taxes locally and uses it for his army. He increases or expands. He adds new provincial taxes or increases tax rates. He mortgages public properties and future revenues from taxes for foreign loans. He gets a number of very substantial foreign loans. And then finally, he's very lucky that he has a mint. So he uses the provincial mint to basically print a lot of money when he actually reaches that point of crisis. In the end, though, none of these means could keep up with his expansion of his military forces. And the desire to increase your military forces continues all this time. It's not like I've reached the goal I need, because all your other people in the surrounding provinces are increasing their forces as well. Therefore, I need another brigade, another brigade, another brigade, another division. It just keeps going. So actually, his resources can't ever meet the needs that he has. And then the end result then is many of his troops, so he's got his kind of core army, he tries to make sure they're paid, but they're not always paid either. But some of the lesser forces don't get paid, sometimes for as long as 7 months, there's no pay. So very long periods without pay. What that means is by 1919, 1920, you begin to see a number of troop mutinies all throughout Hubei by these forces who aren't getting paid anymore. Basically what they're doing is getting their pay from the people by going out and pillaging whatever the town they're garrisoning. What this did is then lead him to more coercive means to try to raise funds he needs for this. And in essence, what he does is order organizations like the Chamber of Commerce to advance, right? Not it's not taxed. Give me the money in advance, I'll pay you back later. Advance the money he needs for his troop pay under the threat that if they don't pay this money, he will be unable to control his troops from these kind of mutinies that are happening. So it's kind of a protection racket. You pay me to pay my troops, and I'll make sure my troops won't have any more mutinies, you know? So it's really a bad situation. So here, what we see here then is this kind of maximization of revenues to support his political power, which is usually cited as one of the main parts of a definition of predatory rule, that maximization of revenue is what predatory rulers do. And in this case, then, in terms of predatory warlordism, what this maximization of revenue is generally doing is directed against increasing military forces, supporting that constant expansion of military forces. And this kind of drives this need to constantly maximize revenue. One of the main problems I have with the general theories of predatory rule is that they have a tendency to overgeneralize. So one of the main theories of predatory rule is that predatory rule is exemplified by the maximization of revenue, that predatory rulers are always trying to maximize their revenue. But then they go on to say, well, actually all rulers try to maximize revenues. Therefore, all rulers and therefore all governments are predatory. When you get to that point, it seems to me you've lost the sense of what predatory means. If you say all governments try, this is true, all governments want to increase their revenues as much as possible, and if you consider efforts to increase your revenue predatory, then all governments are predatory, and the sense of the word predatory loses any kind of analytical clarity. So then, again, that's why I reduced my definition a bit to say that I think predatory warlordism in particular should be used in cases where public office is used not only to maintain, you know, to maximize revenues, to maintain political power, to build up those military forces, but also to increase personal wealth. There has to be this element of kind of a predatory ruler of increasing personal wealth, not just maintaining your military base, to be really considered a predatory warlord. And I think Wong is a classic study of this. Because the main thing, despite all his efforts of raising money for his troops, he also lost no opportunity to try to enrich himself, to line his own pockets from his office. In other words, what he did is put, in some ways, his own personal enrichment over the welfare of his own men. So his men are not getting paid, but he's still getting rich. Right? So in some ways, he could have used that money. He's making a choice here between, do I pay my troops or do I pay myself? And he's going to pay himself. More than pay himself. I mean, it's not just a salary. So there's a number of different ways that he enriched himself over this short period that he was military governor of Hubei. The foundation of his wealth is simply embezzlement. I mean, he just embezzles funds. But you have to hide this in ways, too. So one of the main ways he does this is he creates ghost soldiers. So in every unit, you'll have these special red lines. You have these names of these soldiers, have a red line under them. These are not real people. What the red line means is they are assigned to the military governor's personal guard. And therefore, their salaries get sent to the governor so he can pay them directly. They don't really exist. And one of the people that was in charge of these accounts actually noted that the total number of these red-lined ghost soldiers was actually equivalent to a whole brigade. So in essence, he's taking the entire salaries of a brigade of soldiers and paying himself that money every month. So this is a big source of his revenue. He also used his position to profit himself in lots of other ways. He shipped a lot of private goods, or personal goods, or commercial goods on military trains. So he has access to trains for military supplies. He uses those military trains to ship goods from Hubei north to Beijing or other places, and then sells those goods. That means he escapes all the transit taxes, the taxes and transit costs, right? So basically, he has free transit for all these goods, and he makes a lot of profit on these trades. He also did some very complicated things with currency, currency manipulation. Hubei actually had a lot of copper resources, and you have at this time all sorts of different currencies, and I don't want to get into this, but he has the mint. So he has the mint buy up all this copper locally, which is very cheap in Hubei, to create copper yuan. The exchange rate for copper yuan is better in northern China, though, compared to silver. So then he uses his military transport to transport huge masses of copper yuan up to Beijing, where he trades it for silver yuan, which gives him a profit. So this is again, he's using his control of the mint. Basically to print as many copper yuan as he wants to, and then uses that to exchange it for silver, mint, silver yuan, which gives him a profit in the currency exchange. So all sorts of ways of doing this. And then finally, he also establishes factories in Hubei for military goods, and then he orders all leather plants, uniforms, bedding, things like that. And all police and military units are ordered to buy all their supplies from his factories, which then have inflated prices. Right, so there's all sorts of ways he uses his position to make wealth for himself. But this founding of factories in Hubei for military supplies also shows his main path, his actually third path of wealth, and ultimately ends up being his main path of wealth, and that is using the funds he raises for other kinds of investments. Over the years, he invested in electric light plants, flour mills, banks, textile mills, tea shops, and hotels. He also did a lot of land speculation, so he ends up with kind of the Chinese way of calculating property is about even the number of jian, number of rooms. He ends up with total property holdings of about 6,000 jian, so 6,000 rooms of property in different sorts. But he also buys a lot of land just for speculative purposes. One of the main things he does through this period is wherever there's a drought in China, he sends agents to the drought areas, buys up all the land from the starving people there, and then as the drought recovers, he rents it out, and then he sells it back to them and makes an enormous profit. So usually in one area in particular, he got the land for at the rate of 0.6 yuan per mu for like Chinese acre. He sold it back later on for 600 yuan per mu. So that's like what, 10,000% interest on or return on his investment. So he makes a ton of money in this kind of land speculation. So in the end, a lot of his wealth is really based on being something of an entrepreneur. But that original capital he gained for being this entrepreneur, of course, comes from his political power, which comes in turn from his military force. So again, paying attention to his military force was essential. So it's like this kind of circular thing. You know, being an entrepreneur comes from the capital, gets from being political power, political power comes from military force. Therefore, he has to maintain his military force to maintain his political power so he can be an entrepreneur. So these things go around in a circle. But one of my points here in emphasizing his Wang as a predatory warlord is to note that his prey was not just the civilians, right, civilian society, but also his own troops, right? He's also feeding off of his own troops. He's a predator on his own troops. And that is because he is prioritizing his own personal wealth over the troop pay that his troops are actually supposed to get. And it's this decision he makes to prioritize in this way that actually leads to his downfall. First of all, of course, his constant efforts to raise revenues, particularly when it gets to the point where he's doing this extortion racket. You know, unless you give me 1 million yuan next month immediately, I don't know if I can control my troops. Really angers a lot of people, as you can imagine. It becomes to be this kind of popular anti-Wang movement that's calling for his removal. Secondly, though, his own greed exacerbated his troop pay problem, which alienates him from his own troops. And one thing he talks about, the popular movement, they don't have to do anything about, I don't have to worry about them because I have the guns. But actually, the guns are held by his men, not by him. And they become increasingly alienated by the fact that they're not getting paid. And so the mutinies in Hubei continue to grow. And we have this kind of culmination of this vicious cycle until we get to the, and again, of course, then when we have these mutinies, then that creates even more popular opposition. So you have popular opposition that leads to more mutinies, and mutinies lead to more popular opposition. The culmination of this vicious cycle happens in June 1921, when there's a mutiny by his main core troops, his own personal core troops, that he actually treats better than all the other troops, in the provincial capital itself, which, you know, kind of shows you have no ability to control your own forces. But it's actually set off by a scheme he has to try to increase his number of troops without increasing the amount of revenues. So he wants to have more troops with the same amount of revenue. And his scheme for doing this is he realizes that the older troops that have been with him for, say, 10 years are paid at a much higher rate than new recruits. So best thing to do is to disband the entire older sets of troops, all the loyal people that have been following him for years, and replace them all with new recruits. He's going to get 2 soldiers for every one. So this is going to be this enormous expansion. Also, the good thing about it, he just promised the central government that he's going to disband some of his troops out of patriotism, right, to reduce the burden on the people. So first of all, he can disband all these troops and say, see, I did it. And then he'll, on the side, recruit new ones and have twice the number of troops that he had before. But again, that where greed comes into this, he also decides he's not going to pay his troops the back pay they're owed, or the kind of, severance pay, right? So there's actually rules. You know, if you're going to disband troops, you pay them their back pay, and you pay them 2 months severance pay. He says, well, I'll give you 1 month's pay. Okay, so that's it. So his troops, you know, these are people who have been following him for years, and they are just outraged by this. And so they mutiny and basically burn down the provincial capital and loot everything to take home with them. But part of their anger, of course, so the people are the victims in this case. So they pillage the capital, and so those are the people really suffering from this. But they're also very angry because, in their view, Wang Zhanyan has used them to become very wealthy, and now he's throwing them out. So this is a betrayal in terms of that personal level too, that he's become this extremely wealthy person. You have all this money and you say you can't pay us. So there's really a connection here between his predatory behavior and what actually happens. This mutiny is actually the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the anti-Wang movement. There's these enormous demonstrations in Beijing. In Tiananmen Square, actually, you have thousands of people, Hubei residents and friends of the Hubei residents, who mass up in these massive demonstrations in march on the president's office and the premier's office to demand that Wang Zhanyuan be removed. The problem, of course, and the president and the premier all end up saying, yeah, he's really terrible. We think he should be removed. But you have to understand that there's nothing really we can do. which kind of showed this relationship. You know, the government really has no control over these people. So, of course, what the leaders of this anti-Wall movement do is go to other warlords. The only people that can remove him are other warlords. And the other warlords are looking at this situation and say, well, here's a great opportunity. Here's obviously a guy in controlling a very rich resource who can't even control his own troops. So Hubei is invaded first from troops from Sichuan and Hunan, and then he gets help of the Beiyang army, then comes in to help Wang Zhanyuan. But their help basically is to say, okay, we've moved our troops in. We're not going to actually help you, though, defend yourself against an invasion until you resign. So they basically force him out, and a new Beiyang warlord takes over in Hubei and gets rid of the other invading forces. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is there's a direct correlation here between this kind of predatory behavior we see in Wang Zhanyuan and his fall from power. It kind of stirred up both popular anger, which kind of justifies people trying to get rid of him and other warlords moving against him, but also troop dissatisfaction, which makes it possible to overthrow him because he can't control his own troops. And the end result, of course, for Hubei is it simply replaces one warlord with another. This is one of the flaws of this system of calling on other warlords to help you against a worse warlord. The effects on Wang Zhanyuan are fairly minimal, though. He retires to Tianjin, one of his four massive mansions that he has in different cities in northern China, and where he pursues his alternate career as an entrepreneur. So he continues to invest in all sorts of enterprises and land holdings and to the end of his life. One example. One thing I think is kind of interesting then about looking at Wang Zhanyuan as this predatory ruler, in contrast to the more theoretical work on this, most of the work on predatory rulers take the nation as the unit of analysis. And so the conclusion is that if you have a case of predatory rule where rulers are enriching themselves, that is done at the detriment of the nation, right? Obviously, economic development can't happen because the resources of the nation are being raided. Now, it's certainly true that Hubei probably did not benefit very much from Wang Zhanyuan. He definitely did not do any kind of public goods. You know, he was not going to improve the irrigation system. He wasn't going to build roads. He wasn't going to do any of that stuff because he wanted the money to either go to the military or to himself. On the other hand, just as modern-day predatory rulers take their money and invest it outside their countries, you know, send it abroad for investments and make a lot of money doing it that way, what Wang Zhanyuan did, of course, is take his money and invest it in North China. Very deliberate about this. He looked at other warlords who lost their positions and said, you know, if you invest in your home province, you might lose it when you retire. But if you invest it elsewhere, that's where you're going to retire too. So most of his investments were in Tianjin and Beijing and other places in northern China, in Shandong and other places. So that became kind of his retirement places. His main residence, one of his main residences, is still kind of a tourist attraction today, one of these mansions that he lived in. So the strange result of warlordism in China is that warlordism became a source of capital accumulation. The warlords, accumulated a lot of capital and are responsible for some of the main industrial development in northern China. So this is the source of China's development as warlordism. And I don't really want to make that, you know, that's kind of, obviously warlordism is not a good thing, right? That this was not really good for China. But it does tell us something about economic development in this period. This was a very important area of capital accumulation. The other kind of significant final effect of this is that the role of warlord predation in kind of generating anti-warlord movements. In this period, we find a number of different warlord movements. They're for often different reasons. Sometimes it's because of military atrocities or mutinies or for tax revenues and things like this. There's many reasons for that. But they start off by being very focused on individuals. So this was actually an anti-Wang movement in Hubei. So they wanted to overthrow Wang Zhanyuan. It wasn't like we want to eliminate warlordism. And that's why they can call on other warlords to help out. You know, think, oh, this guy's a better warlord. He'll come in and help out. But what this does, you begin to create this popular image of these corrupt warlords that begins to generate a concept of warlordism as an evil in itself, right? That warlords are corrupt. They are immoral. They are violent. And warlords then have to be removed. So this is the beginning of a transition, I think. This kind of behavior that leads to this anti-Wang movement is the beginning of a transition where people begin to think about warlordism as something, as an evil in itself, and you begin to see anti-warlord movements rather than warlord movements, anti-warlord movements directly against specific warlords. Okay, that's it.
So David's not here yet, right? Okay, you're on.
I'm a PhD candidate at the Ohio State University. The paper I'm going to present today is a part of my dissertation. When I plan for the conference, I haven't decided which I've done to present. So I'm sorry, I apologize that the title of the presentation looks different from the handout. So the paper I'm going to present is called Fish Water Intimacy, the Construction of the Soldier Heroes in Mass Culture in Yan'an during the Second Sino-Japanese War. During the Second Sino-Japanese War, the Chinese Communist Party accumulated strength village by village. Yan'an, a northwest inland city, became the seat of the Shanxi, Gansu, Ningxia border region. In order to ensure the continued popular support for military recruitment, the Chinese communists made strenuous efforts to build army-civilian solidarity in Yan'an. Substantial mass cultural productions were created on the themes of the image of soldier and army people solidarity. Popular slogans such as "the army and the people are as close as one family" and "the emotional connection between the army and the people is like the fish swimming in the sea" dominated mass culture, which was facilitated and appropriated by the communists as a propaganda media in Yan'an. So the question is, what roles do the emotional ties between the communist soldiers and the peasants play in the discourse on soldier heroes? My research approaches this question by examining the party's wartime social and cultural campaigns and by closely reading a representative genre of mass culture in wartime Yan'an, the Yangge dramas. The Yangge drama is selected here as a case study of mass culture on the soldier hero in Yan'an because of its unique social significance. The Yangge targeted both males and females, both the literate and the illiterate. It was officially developed into a mass movement in 1943, and at the same time, the campaign of supporting the army was going on in the border region. Therefore, the Yangge serves as the best window to examine the political and the social background of the discourse on soldiers' masculinities and how different forces participated in the construction of that sort of that discourse. In the Yangge drama, a symbol of mass culture in Yan'an, cultural propagandists celebrated the emotional ties between soldiers and the peasants as an integrated factor in defining a soldier hero. The construction of CCP soldier heroes within the framework of army people intimacy in wartime mass culture was crucial for the CCP's project of managing close social integration in their revolutionary base. My study on the construction of soldiers' heroes in wartime mass culture in Yan'an will attempt to engage dialogue with previous scholarship on Chinese communist revolution, Chinese masculinity, and wartime popular culture. Existing studies examine the CCP's wartime success in military mobilization in a paradigm of double appeals, national resistance, and socio-economic and political reforms. This framework is based on the presumption of rationality in decision-making and behaviors on the part of the CCP and on the part of the peasants. The construction of soldier heroes within the framework of army people emotional ties will add a cultural perspective to existing scholarship on Chinese Revolution. Feminist scholars argue that normative masculinity continues to be associated with a form of rationality that requires the suppression of the emotional aspects of subjectivity. The Enlightenment theory of rationality was highly gendered. Men were associated with reason and rationality, whereas women were associated with emotion and irrationality. However, this Western rationality oriented understanding of masculinity does not apply to the construction of soldier heroes in wartime communist mass culture. Male soldiers and peasants described in the younger drama do not feel guilt or inadequacy when they express their emotions. They were often strengthened rather than weakened as a result. Soldiers would not become a military hero, and peasants would not become a moral models if they did not show their love and support to and for each other. The meanings of masculinity are neither transhistorical nor cultural universal, but rather vary from culture to culture and within any culture over time. There's a scholar called Ken Lui. He argues that in Chinese cultural tradition, concepts of manliness have often been structured around the intertwining of two ideas. One means cultural behavior, mastery of scholarly works, and martial prowess, strength, mastery of physical arts. Louis can claim that scholar officials and military officials represented two opposite poles in which Chinese masculine identity was able to be constructed. He also shows the hierarchy within these two ideals of masculinity, with the Wen quality dominant over the Wu quality. The image of a soldier hero in mass culture in Yan'an will show that Wen conveyed a new meaning in wartime Yan'an, the ability to pursue economic production. The CCP's literary rectification movement, which called upon propagandists to write for and write to worker peasants, soldiers, Gong Nongbing, softened the hierarchy between Wen and Wu. The works of the literati could only be justified by writing for and in favor of the soldiers. Confucianism honors five basic human relationships: ruler and root, husband and wife, father and son, elder brother, the younger brother, and friend. The overwhelming celebration of the army people intimacy in CCP's social and cultural movements shows that the CCP aimed to forge a sixth category of social relationship and a distinct venue of male bonding in Yan'an, which is between soldier and peasant. The soldier-peasant social relationship is legitimated by the bonding between parents and the sons. The metaphor of fish water intimacy, Yu Shui Qing, signifying the emotional harmony between men and women in traditional scholar beauty fictions, is appropriated by the CCP propagandists to describe the mutually reliant relationship between the two social groups of soldiers and peasants. It seems a paradox that in Chinese military culture, common soldiers and military heroes are historically regarded with totally different reputations from the masses. On one hand, there exists a well-known saying that continues to resound in China: good iron is never beaten into nails, and a good man never enlists himself as a soldier. Yet on the other hand, soldier heroes in China have been surrounded with the highest level of respect and adoration to the point of cult-like status. Common soldiers enjoyed higher status in Yan'an mass culture and became the heroes in younger plays. The continuity of the traditional military culture is that the popularity of soldier heroes is not solely It's not based solely or even chiefly on the fact that he is a loyal and a strong soldier. Mass culture in Yan'an forged a cult of soldier heroes who came to be known as the embodiment of a number of attributes, the most significant of which was to maintain close emotional ties with the peasants. Well, that's the background, the thesis, and the methodologies of my research, where the first part is an institutional background. It is the political and the social background of the soldier-peasant intimacy. Since the early years of the CCP army in the 1920s, the regulation of army-people relations had been an arena where the CCP practiced political education among soldiers and consolidated its rule among rural peasants. To this end, the CCP tried to build two-way emotional communication between the soldiers and the peasants. Soldiers should respect and love the people, and the people should support the soldiers. In the two important movements, the political and the economic spheres in Yan'an, the rectification movement and the production campaign, emotional ties between soldiers and peasants served as an authentic principle that justified the legitimacy of these movements. Mao Zedong's talks and the 1942 Yan'an Forum on Literatures and Arts show that 大众化 is an effect intended to regulate the emotion of the writers and the artists. Mao gave his own definitions of 大众化 in his talks. What is 大众化? It's that the thoughts and the emotions of the literary arts workers should be compatible with those of the worker, peasant, soldier masses. In Chinese, that means 工农兵应当打成一片. Mao Zedong viewed the symbol of emotional changes as class transformation. The army aimed at a realization that the burden of the military on the strained financial resources of the people could be correspondingly lightened. The celebration of soldier people solidarity was finally institutionalized in the 1943 double supporting movement, 双拥运动, which promoted a spirit of supporting the army, a favorable treatment of soldiers' families, and the cherishing of the people. Next part is on the I will examine the themes of the younger movement, and how the army people intimacy was articulated in the younger movement. The double supporting movement, 双拥运动, was first initiated during the 1943 Spring Festival. According to incomplete statistics taken from CCP archives, this period saw a peak in the performance of Yanggu on the theme of Army People Solidarity. More than 150 Yanggu drummers were performed in 1943. Among them, 56 described the theme of production, 17 the theme of army people solidarity, and 10 on the theme of self-defense. It's hard to assess the completeness of these statistics, but it's reasonable to argue that production and army people solidarity are the two most popular themes. In this younger plays that portray soldier hero imagery, the comradeship between soldiers and their feelings toward their lovers, their families, are both obscured. The soldiers are all single males in this place, and their social emotions has only one focus, which was a desire for attachment with the peasants. The 1942 literary rectification was a watershed in the discourse on the army people solidarity. Before the rectification, the younger drummers tended to portray communist soldiers as a force that morally transcended the masses, physically protected the masses, and offered the people more help than the people offered the army. The younger plays were full of sentences such as, "Every river had its source, and every tree had its roots," or "The Eight-Root Army was the lifeblood of us peasants and our parents." These younger drummers also highlighted the merits of the army by writing the negative sides of the peasants. During the literary rectification, the ideal emotions between soldiers and the peasants were drawn as a parallel to some parent relationship dynamics. By celebrating the peasants' role as soldiers' parents, the CCP's cultural leaders aimed to construct a patriarchal hierarchy between the masculinities of two different male groups, soldiers and the peasants. This hierarchy represented the CCP's efforts to pursue the continued popular support from male peasants. To exchange experiences in production becomes the arena where soldiers and the peasants build and strengthened their emotional ties. Male peasants no longer play the role as a helper. They are the soldiers' teachers. They are the soldiers' protectors. They wielded their authority in productive work over the soldiers by assuming the role as soldiers' teachers. The soldiers relied on the peasants to produce work tools and requested the peasants to check the quality of their farm work. The soldiers' expression of respectful emotions for peasants' authority in productive knowledge fulfilled his image as a soldier hero. By effeminizing soldiers as injured and thus weakened, the younger drummers even described the peasants as the protector of the soldiers. The expression of emotions between soldiers and peasants was highly gendered. Peasant soldier emotions were justified by traditional father-son bonds, one of the five human relationships in Confucianism. The soldier said that the peasants were his parents who gave him a second life. And the peasants replied that the eight root army soldiers were the children of the masses. The way the peasant wife showed her love for the soldier hero was to cook for the family, although the definition of family was enlarged to include strange soldiers. The celebration of army people intimacy reinforced patriarchal values by stressing women's domestic roles. Now comes to the conclusion. The CCP's political, economic, and cultural policies established army people intimacy as a legitimate category of social emotion in Yan'an. As Mao and his associates pressed for a new mass culture that drew on China's own folk tradition, Yang'e, a new discourse on soldier heroes was forged along the lines of army people intimacy. Chinese communist soldiers did not hesitate to express their emotion toward peasants. In contrast to the Western rationality-oriented masculinity, the expression of emotions was integrated into the masculinity of a Chinese communist soldier hero. The Maoist discourse on the soldier heroes in mass culture engineered social emotions between soldiers and peasants as a method of political mobilization. The army people intimacy celebrated in mass culture was gendered in a way that strengthened the patriarchal authority of male peasants. The mobilization of this social emotion is crucial for the rapid development of the CCP army in the border region during the war. Thank you.
So, last chance for David Silby. No. Okay. Let's see your own. So we'll just take the four questions, and we'll go to however long it goes. Harold.
With regard to your warlord friend, I'm kind of interested in, it's not historically terribly significant, but what was he like as a person? What did he do with this wealth other than buy some nice houses? And he made investments. Clearly, evidently, he was not as self-indulgent as, say, a Zhang Zhongchang, for example. What sort of thing did, how did he live and what did he do with his wealth?
Well, he had a number of wives, you know, kind of the normal, and they liked to go shopping. But he was incredibly stingy. And he used to like show people, see this chair here? I've had this ever since I was a junior officer, and I've carried it with me in all my campaigns, and it's still here in my house. And he liked to wear, you know, clothes till they wore out and things like this. So, and he was very upset when his wives went on these shopping trips and when his sons would buy stuff. And so and that's part of the reason why he's wealthy, because he was incredibly interested in making a lot of money, but not so interested in spending it. So that's one, but that's the other part of his character, in that his subordinates kind of hated this. He also felt, for as he criticized other warlords or other commanders who let their subordinates get away with corruption. He wanted to make sure his own men were not corrupt. And so one of the ruses played by one of his top subordinates is he wore these very fine robes in his office. When he went to go see John, he changed into old ragged clothes so it looked like he wasn't corrupt. Even though they were all corrupt, he tried to present himself as being poor in front of Wang so he wouldn't get after him on it. So it's this kind of very strange guy that insulted all his subordinates, even while he became incredibly wealthy. He also tried to, in his own kind of statements, he never claimed. So, you know, people think I was corrupt and that's why I became wealthy. I wasn't corrupt, I'm just a very good businessman. It kind of begged the question about where he got the capital to be a good businessman, which was from corruption. So it's kind of this, he had this image problem.
Can I ask Leon a question? It seems to me from my reading of modern Chinese history that I think, maybe you can tell me wrong, but Mao had such a strong connection with the revolutionary army, peasants, and so forth, that during his time of leadership, when he made enormous mistakes, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, all this kind of stuff that took place, but there was always a certain degree of forgiving factor toward Mao. And even now, you know, when they ask people of certain age generations that, they still see Mao as a very positive figure, despite millions dying from his decisions. And you see less support for Mao among the younger generations who don't have that emotional connection, I think, that you were talking about. Would that be a correct interpretation?
I think the emotional ties, the value of emotion, really marks the Chinese masculinities. You're right, like in my parents' generation, they have some special ties with Mao Zedong. But here, I mean, especially I have received Western education, I study history, so I can try to maintain an objective view on him. And in every ways, in the emotion, they define the Chinese people's mentality, including the soldiers. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, I think so. There's a question for Ed. Your concept, your predatory concept, just reading into what you had to say today, I would perhaps define it as high level corruption and lack of legitimizing ideology. If you get a warlord or government that's operating in that manner, you know, you might define it as predatory, but you didn't really discuss ideology. So basically, I'd like you to comment on that, and then also I ask, did he make any efforts to legitimize his rule? It's really fascinating seeing both of your talks side to side. You know, here you can see the communist efforts to at least create the image of good government, good army, and you know, and this, it's like a pendulum in Chinese history going back and forth, and we're in an age now in 2012 where it's really swinging towards the lack of ideology, high levels of corruption, and we're getting away from that earlier vision. So, I don't know, what do you think of
There actually is a connection, because it's just the you know, 1911 revolution, the status of the military went up, and then the warlord period, it went way down again, and there's clearly an obvious effort by both the Nationalist Party and the Communist Party to raise the prestige of military positions again. And that myth, there's a certain moral element to it, right? To make that work, the warlords are seen as so morally corrupt that you needed an alternative kind of moral perfection in some ways. So I think there is a connection there. In terms of ideology, he did have an ideology. My guy did have an ideology. It wasn't a very expansive ideology, but what he thought his popular support was based on. He maintained order, and that was his claim. And in his early years, it's true. So Hubei actually escaped a lot of the civil wars of the period. Hubei's right in between kind of the North-South wars. He acts as kind of like a supply center for all the different armies that go through Hubei going to other places, which he makes enormous profits off of as well. You know, he makes them also buy his supplies, and then he charges the central government for those supplies at exorbitant rates. But he claims that he kept peace, he kept Hubei out of civil war, and he maintained order. And he had makes these statements periodically, who but I could keep order in this province? And the problem is, of course, by 1919, where you're getting like dozens of mutinies breaking out, where they basically, his own troops begin pillaging towns, that wears rather thin. So he does have an ideology that his, and that's why he says, one of his subordinates says, you know, why don't you like do some irrigation works or do something, you know, build a road or something, so he has like a legacy for the future. And basically says, I don't have time for that. My job is to maintain order. Right, so my job is to keep building my military force so I have to keep order. That's what my claim, and no one else is doing it either, by the way, so I'm not going to do it. But so he does have an ideology, but it's a very narrow kind of ideology.
Question for Professor McCoy. So what happened to Wang Zhanyuan after he got driven out as governor of Hubei?
He retired to luxury in northern China. His main home was in Tianjin. A number of people sued him at different points in time, so he did run from one residence to the other to escape the courts. One of his commanders, who actually sued him for non-payment of, how you can do this? So a commander whose army is no longer existing sues him for non-payment of his troops back in this period, and wants the courts to make Wang pay for what he failed to pay him back, pay his troops back then, the money which would have gone to the commander who sued him. So you're not really sure how that works. They eventually settle out of court. But he basically has a very luxurious, not much. Again, he's a stingy guy. So he has he keeps accumulating more and more wealth until he dies, I think, 1931. He does also keep trying to get back to his position. He's very resentful that his fellow warlords basically kicked him out of his position. And he does all this stuff that he hates. He's socialized with all the warlords in northern China, trying to get them to give him his position back. And one thing he does is lots of gambling, which he hates losing money at gambling. And it really, you know, so he gambles with Zhang Suolin. Whenever Zhang Suolin comes to town, he goes on his, and Zhang Suolin loved to gamble. And the only way to give his good favor was to lose. So he had to lose at all these gambling parties, and he hated that. But he kept trying to get his position back that way. There's all this stuff that's not in my paper that's just really fascinating that there's no room for it.
I have a question for Yan Xu. So I was very interested because, you know, we're back to this talking about single men, and one of the things that's, if you're not doing the scholar and beauty plays in pre-modern China, you know, Shui Huizhuan, all that stuff, I mean, it really is all about this male, single men and their emotions together, and women are really kind of, I mean, and a lot of people when you do Chinese film, you know, martial arts films, love affairs are really not, Westerners often say, like, well, you know, there's no love affair here. There's just these guys bonding, and that's okay. I guess it's this challenging issue of the masculinities. To what extent are these yanga? I mean, are they completely consistent with sort of the martial, with the wuxia pen, or are they? I mean, are they a reformulation of that, or are they something else entirely different? I mean, because it sounded like what you were saying is that it's using the scholar and beauties form and then replacing that with soldier and peasant. But is it totally different than these other, you know, martial tales?
I think you are asking two questions. One is
at least two, I think.
the younger drama with the martial arts,
yeah.
And the like the
yeah.
And the other question is the younger and the traditional scholar building fiction like Tianzi Jiaren Xiaoshuo. I think for the first one with the martial arts, if you saw some fictions and the newspaper reports written by the Kuomintang areas, you see like the heroes, the war heroes, they are not formally trained soldiers. Sometimes they are like Lao Taipo, who were very smart and courageous to kill the enemy, or even a widow, or even a kid, or even an a soldier with an injured body, those strong soldiers who have a very hard will largely appear in the Kuomintang's propagandists and their 民众教育, like in Feng Yuxiang's 抗日模范军人, like this